Hello everyone. Today I'm going to be talking about Carl Schmitt, who I, in the Populist Delusion, grouped with the elite theorists. I also talk quite a bit about Carl Schmitt in this book, Applied Elite Theory. But it should be noted that before I wrote the Populist Delusion, it was not typically done to group Schmitt with the elite theorists. That's Mosca, Pareto and Michels. You can go back to my previous three lectures if you don't know who those guys are and watch those. He really comes from a slightly, he comes from a legal background. He was a judicial scholar, Schmitt, and doesn't really come out of that elite theory school. He's got different background. He was part of something called the Conservative Revolution in Germany in the interwar period. That's between World War One and World War Two. Now, you will hear people like James Lindsay, you know, call him a Nazi and say he's, you know, Hitler's lawyer and things like this. The truth is a little bit more complicated than that. He, if you actually understand what Schmitt was saying properly, he was warning again. I mean, he was basically saying like the prospect of something like a Hitler arising, or maybe a communist dictator, you know, somebody who's opposed to the liberal state taking over that state and then abolishing parliamentary democracy, was basically an inevitability in the Weimar, you know, in the Weimar, you know, setup. He was more or less warning against this, you know, when he wrote, you know, his kind of early books. So I wouldn't really take much notice about that kind of scaremongering. When I was researching Populist Delusion, I found that Carl Schmitt had largely been rehabilitated in academia going right back to the 70s and 80s. He's such an important thinker that it's not like it's forbidden to write books and essays about him. And people did that on the left and on the right in the 80s and the 90s. And now it's pretty much commonplace to discuss Schmitt in the academy. And, you know, owing to my work and some other people, you'll see Schmitt discussed on the internet quite a bit as well. And for various reasons, because of the increased politicization and polarization of society, Schmitt has become more and more relevant as Western liberal democracy has started showing signs of breaking down, and you know the fights in America between the left and the right that start to feel existential means that Schmitt is very much a theorist who speaks to our time. So let us get on now with his theories. One thing I'd like to say before we get started properly here is that Schmitt is a very easy person to read, in my opinion. He's a very concise and clear writer, and that's something I value a great deal. Now, people say that The Populist Delusion is not a very long book, and that's one of the things that people actually like about it, that it's not that long. Carl Schmitt's books are even shorter than The Populist Delusion. You could quite easily read his top two or three most important works in the case of a couple of days. He writes with such precision and such, you know, he just gets to the point. And I really appreciate that about him because so many continental writers, French, German, you know, Italian, tend to waffle on. Schmitt just gets straight in there and he means what he says. He's also very difficult to argue against, in my opinion. And I think that's why he gets smears from the likes of James Lindsay and various other liberal critics, because it's easier to point and to call him names or to try to smear him by association with some of the other Germans who are around there than to actually deal with the very serious ideas that he has. I also think that because of the short and concise nature, and because it's quite easy to grasp, it's also quite easy for people to start oversimplifying Schmitt, which has started to You know, there's a kind of meme version of Schmidt that started to develop. And hopefully in this lecture, I will do my best to give a full appraisal, not just a kind of meme version of Schmidt. Okay. The first and most famous idea from Schmidt is that the political, what defines politics and what defines the political as a category, is the friend-enemy distinction. For Schmidt, the political is not a domain alongside economics or morality. It is a fundamental intensity of association and dissociation. Any opposition reaches a political character when it has an intense enough, it's become intense enough to group your enemies as an existential threat. And it's, this word existential is quite important because there are lots of people who are in politics who may have some mild disagreements. You know, but back at some point in British history, there was something called the post-war consensus. Tories and Labour, you know, they had some disagreements over, you know, this spending bill or that spending bill. But fundamentally, their view of the world was the same. They just had a couple of disagreements around the edges. That's not what is meant by enemy. That is not existential. I would argue that in American civil and political life over the past decade, certainly with the rise of Donald Trump, when the liberal left and when the socialist left decided that they were going to treat Donald Trump and his supporters as mortal enemies, as an enemy to be smited, as an existential threat, and then at the same time, as woke ideology was pushed, as you know, ways of thinking that are fundamentally alien to many normal Americans were pushed. The same thing has happened to a lesser degree in this country, by the way. But as those alien ideologies were pushed on a large scale, people came to see woke, quote unquote woke, the woke left or the far left as being an existential threat to their way of life. And this clash of two sets of people who see the other person not as, you know, fellow human beings, where they're working together to come to the best outcome for the country. That is not what is happening in the friend-enemy distinction. That enemy is there to be overcome, to be smited. They are an existential threat to you. Okay, and it prefigures the condition of war. Politics is war by other means. Now, so this is Schmidt's idea of the friend-enemy distinction. Now, what is important to understand about Schmidt is that he wasn't talking about politics as normal. And I'll bring myself up here to this really hits home. Schmidt was not talking about politics as normal. If politics within a country reaches the stage of being the friend-enemy distinction, then the nation is in trouble. And this was Schmidt's point. And what he was saying is that democracy, or parliamentary democracy, has a habit of exacerbating these differences so that small disagreements, you know, then get snowballed up and up and up until it starts to look like an existential threat, and then the state's got a problem. Schmidt argued that the ideal state of things was that more or less everybody in a society believed the same sort of stuff, that there's a certain degree of homogeneity, and so you don't have this cognitive political split at every level. He would look at the way Western society has gone in America or in Britain and say, like, you can't have a functional society where the friend-enemy distinction is starting to, you know, it's not just at the level of left versus right, or, you know, Labour versus Tory, or Republican versus Democrat, but also husband versus wife, man versus woman, you know, this group versus that group, you know, the straights versus the LGBTs or whatever. This is not a recipe for a successful society. Schmidt believed that to a certain degree, there had to be a level of uniformity homogeneity. Otherwise, you don't have social cohesion. And so the friend-enemy distinction is not actually something that you want in your politics. And this was one of his arguments. This was his warning, really, about the Weimar Republic. He was saying, like, look, this is a problem. You'll see it, you know, all of these people, don't forget, they were hardcore communists in interwar Germany. There were liberals and there were, of course, the National Socialists. And these people absolutely hated each other. They saw, each saw their enemy groups as existential threats. And Schmidt was saying, you know, look, this is the nature of the political, that in a good, well-run society, this should not be part of internal politics. The friend-enemy distinction ideally should be between external, you know, everybody's a friend at home and your enemies are external. Your enemies are external, other countries, other groups out there somewhere. And we're all on the same side here in this country. Okay, so that, you know, that's the well-run, healthy version of things. All the people at home are friends, or everybody out there is enemy. That's the ideal scenario for Schmidt. Where things have gone wrong is where internal politics has the friend-enemy distinction, you know, erupting. It's a precursor to civil disorder, civil war, breakdown of an order. Second point is that sovereignty is the power to decide the exception. Sovereign is he who decides the exception. Now, this is another one of Schmidt's really famous maxims. And what he was talking about is that the normal legal order of things, the law as it stands for everyday people, as it stands for me and you, is suspended in emergency conditions for the powers that be. It's suspended for war. It's suspended for things like natural disasters. If you know, everybody watching this will have lived through COVID-19 pandemic. During the COVID pandemic, normal order was suspended, and Parliament in this country adopted all sorts of extra legal powers and rode roughshod over the normal order of things. This is also known as the Schmittian exception. Now, if you've been watching me for a long time, this is something I mention in casual conversation all the time, the Schmittian exception. This is what we're talking about. Schmidt maintained that you can look, it's no point trying to figure out what a system is about or who's in power or who makes the decisions by looking at the normal run of play, right? That's things working as normal. That's just business as usual. You can really tell who's in charge in the system when there's the exception. Who's calling the shots then? What happens then? That shows you the real power structure. And remember what happened during COVID-19. You got to see actual power manifest itself and reveal itself in that moment. You don't usually see that side of the state, but it kicked into action during COVID-19 with all those emergency powers. The president of the USA has now got a long history of using various emergency powers to do all sorts of things. And you can see why people say, well, Schmidt's ideas led to Hitler. Well, Hitler used emergency powers to become, to suspend Parliament, to become the Führer, to establish the Third Reich. He used emergency powers after the Reichstag fire. And of course, you know, you can look at Schmidt's work and say, well, this is the playbook. You know, it's not, but if you understand what Schmidt is saying, what Hitler did was not actually that exceptional. That's actually the normal run of power. Schmidt's point is that all power systems do this. All power systems do this all the time. And where Hitler was different is that by actually declaring himself the sovereign, in some way you could say, well, he was putting himself above, you know, law as normal. But what Schmitt would say is that actually maybe he was just being more honest than power usually is by making this move. He was just revealing how things normally operate by doing away with the various populist delusions that keep these mechanisms hidden in the normal run of things. In Populist Delusion, I gave lots of examples of the American president using emergency powers, and I listed lots of them, which have been on the books since 1917. So, for example, when the United States declared a national emergency during the First World War, that was Woodrow Wilson, that executive order by Wilson has never been repealed. Okay. There was Jimmy Carter has got executive orders that are still on the books. Powers invoked by George W. Bush during the so-called War on Terror were never rescinded. So there are a lot, you can see who's really in charge in these moments. And this is one of those things that people really struggle to see, because they want to default certain type of mindset, wants to say, oh, well, hold on a second, the Constitution doesn't say that. Or that's, you know, the law doesn't say that. How have they done that? The law doesn't say that. And you see this come up again and again and again, especially in American politics, where the Constitution is something of a kind of minor religion among certain Republicans. But what Schmitt would say is, look, the law is just a piece of paper. The law is not in power. The people in power are in power. And if the people in power think it's important enough, they can ignore those bits of paper. They'll have ways to work around it. They'll enact emergency powers. They will invoke the Schmittian exception. Now, the Schmittian exception is a very, very useful analytical tool, because in certain crunch points, in certain emergencies, people can see who gets the Schmittian lever pulled for them, and in other situations, who does not get the Schmittian lever pulled for them. And in recent times, both in Britain and America, more and more people have noticed that the Schmittian lever is pulled for some groups of people, but is not pulled for other groups of people. That certain Schmittian exceptions are made, you know, based on racial grounds, based on whatever grounds, okay, or if somebody belongs to, you know, the right elite class, they get one set of rules, whereas everybody else has to follow a different set of rules. And this is generally not a very popular thing, which is why why most systems in most times and places maintains the idea that the sovereign is not above the law, even though and Schmitt's point is that in practice the sovereign has to be, because otherwise things couldn't get done. Sometimes you need an executive decision to get made as a matter of urgency. Third, liberalism tries to neutralize politics. Liberalism substitutes parliamentary deliberation and procedural debate for decisive political will. So instead of taking these actions, liberalism will say, oh, well, what we'll do is, we'll have a committee meeting about it. Or we'll publish a report about it. Or there's going to be an investigation into it. Whereas what the system may need is, this thing needs to get done. This needs decisive action right now. And liberalism loves to hide behind procedure all the time. You can see this in the British system. Whenever there's a crisis in British politics, it's like, there's going to be a report. That buys the political class 2 or 3 years, because nothing will be done in the meantime. It tries to neutralize politics at the level of economics. Political conflicts are reframed as problems of resource allocation and market management. One of the experts at neutralizing politics is, of course, my favorite, Tony Blair. Tony Blair basically frames all of his arguments as already beyond politics, as a done deal, as a, you know, as apolitical, as beyond politics. During COVID-19, Tony Blair said, how can people be arguing about taking the vaccine? This is not a political decision. So Tony Blair didn't even understand that having a needle in your arm is a political decision. And he was distraught at that. And even during, people forget about this now, but he suggested that that people should be segregated into the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, and that separate spaces need to be maintained, almost like creating an anointed and a benighted during that time. So that was interesting. Anyway, there's also procedure. Legitimacy is relocated to formal rules, stripping politics of its existential urgency. So all of these things that we talked about. Liberalism loves the appearance that it's neutral. You know, I've talked about the neutral frame before, Tony Blair's rhetorical word games. And the reason that this is an issue is that obviously you cannot escape the political. You cannot forever kick the can down the road, because at some point, you know, the birds are going to come home to roost. The friend-enemy distinction cannot be dissolved by debate. It can only be obscured until it reemerges in more dangerous forms. And one of the things that we're seeing at the moment is liberalism's failure to quash these emergent friend-enemy distinctions between, you know, various left-wing groups and various right-wing groups, or, you know, the discontent of the masses with immigration, for example. And this is where you start to get the breakdown of the political system. Fourth idea from Carl Schmitt is the state of exception reveals the truth. In normal times, legal order masks the underlying political decisions that sustain it. Crisis strips away the mask. The state of exception is epistemically privileged. It exposes who actually holds sovereign authority and on what basis the entire legal edifice rests. The exception is more interesting than the rule. The rule proves nothing. The exception proves everything. And I have focused on this in many different areas. Okay, in geopolitics, why is it that some countries seem to get away quite literally with murder, and other countries get the book thrown at them by the U.S.? Like, why is it that, you know, the U.S. president turns a blind eye when some countries do things, and when other countries do things, oh, well, it's a humanitarian crisis? This double standard, this Schmittian exception, is now so glaring that many people all around the world are asking the same question. Okay, and this is where, when the truth comes out, okay, that can lead to discontent as well. Democracy requires hegemony. Schmitt draws a sharp distinction between liberalism and democracy. Democracy for Schmitt presupposes a relatively homogeneous demos, a people capable of collective self-determination through shared identity and shared will. Without this substantive unity, majority voting is mere arithmetic, not genuine popular sovereignty. Heterogeneity, he argues, produces not democracy, but oligarchic management of competing groups. And if you think about, okay, the way the multicultural, multi-plural liberal democracy that we have now, it does start to resemble an oligarchic management of various competing groups who don't like each other, with every group kind of wailing and crying for their little gifts, for their little democratic gifts. This is not good functioning democracy, according to Schmitt, because ideally, everybody needs to be friends, right? Whereas in this scenario, with all the competing groups, there are quite a few friend-enemy distinctions in there. And it is the job then of the state to just kind of manage, play off and manage these groups against each other, you know, in order to stay in control. This is suboptimal, to say the least, for Schmitt. Parliamentarianism is outdated, he argued. The classical premise was that parliamentary government was founded on the belief that open deliberation between independent representatives would produce rational, legitimate decisions through the clash of arguments. In the modern reality, however, mass party democracy replaces deliberation with negotiation between organized blocks. This is, you know, if you think about what goes on in Congress, is anybody really debating? Is anybody really changing their minds? And you've got all these different groups, you know, the Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, you know, this Native American group, that Native American group. And they're all just kind of, you know, sitting there as a block. As a kind of, you know, they're not really discussing issues there. Debate becomes theater. You know, and again, American politics is particular, you know, who's that guy, Cory Booker? I mean, it's pure Punch and Judy theatrics again and again. Real decisions are made in committees, back rooms, and coalition pacts, you know, across the street in Davos, not even in the main meeting in Davos, in the little hotel across the road where Tony and his friends are sitting. Schmitt's conclusion is the intellectual foundations of parliamentarianism, publicity, and discussion have been abandoned in practice, rendering the institution a historical relic legitimated by habit alone. And this has become particularly marked in the age of social media, where increasingly parliament, whether it's Prime Minister's Question Time or Congress over in America or the Senate, it's just sound bites to be, you know, for a viral clip on Twitter or social media or TikTok or whatever. It's literally reduced down to that level now, where people just go there to grandstand in order for a viral clip. It's, you know, and Schmitt was saying this back in the 1920s, let's not forget. The friend-enemy distinction is existential and not moral. Okay, it is not that you are kind of wrong. It is not that you're mistaken. It is that, and it's not that I hate you as a personal enemy. It's not like that. It's not a moral evil. It is that the public enemy, okay, the collective other, you belong to this public enemy that I have, whose existential kind of collective power poses a threat to one's own form of life. That's the main issue. So it is not necessarily that people hate the left winger next door to them or hate the right winger next door to them. It is that they believe that if that group got into power, it would fundamentally be an existential threat to the life they enjoy. And this, you know, I mean, in modern debates, this becomes hysterical. Okay. In the case of the right, they believe that if the left get in power, they're going to destroy all aspects of the country, destroy the demographics, destroy the, you know, destroy the moral fabric of the nation and all these sorts of things. The left believe that, you know, if their right wing friends party gets into power, that means that all of the trans people are going to, you know, spontaneously combust and, yeah, you know, their black and Asian friends are going to be deported and all this sort of stuff. So you can see why the clash becomes existential in that way. He talks about the difference between the hostis, the public enemy, the politically threatening collective other, and the inimicus, the private enemy. That's a personal hatred or a rivalry, which is a somewhat different thing. That's like you are my personal enemy as opposed to my public political enemy. Very different thing. Next, two ideas is that the law rests on decision and technology depoliticizes. No constitution is self-grounding. Every legal order presupposes a founding political act, a decision about who constitutes the people and what shall be their basic order that cannot itself be legally derived or justified. The rise of technology and economic management reduces genuinely political questions to technical problems with optimal solutions. This displacement creates the illusion that conflict has been overcome while the political tension merely accumulates below the surface. And again, the perfect embodiment of this is, of course, Tony Blair, who always frames his technological revolutions and all of the various things that he wants as a matter of historical inevitability, not something to be debated. And of course, that means that no actual discussion even takes place, and resentment bubbles under the surface. He argues that the age of neutralization or neutralizations is ending. Of course, when he was writing, that was certainly true because the, let's just say, the Nazis were about to come into power. You could argue that the same is true of this moment. There's not a lot of neutralization going on in politics. Politics seems quite hot in Britain and in America at the current time. He traces modernity as a sequence of attempts to find a neutral domain: theology, metaphysics, ethics, economics, technology, each promising to stand above conflict. Each one of them fails as the very domain becomes the new terrain of political struggle. So there have been religious wars over theology. There have been wars over metaphysics. There have been wars over ethics. There have even been wars over economics. You know, think of the great struggles between communism and capitalism. And there have been struggles over technology as well. And so it was in the 20th century that there were great ideological struggles and struggles over political visions. For Schmitt, the 20th century marks the breakdown of the last neutralization. Technology has itself become politically contested. The political returns irreducibly in force. And that is the end of the basic ideas of Schmitt. Now, hopefully, this was informative, and you can put it together with the first three lectures on the elite theorists, and you can see where this, you know, where this sort of worldview, how it more accurately describes what's going on than either the Marxists or the liberal. You know, the liberals have a habit of trying to reduce everything down to a material. You know, people are just discontent, you know, over their material conditions or something like that, or it's about inequality or something like this. Whereas Schmitt, I think, really gets to the heart of the matter structurally, what goes wrong and what has happened. If you're interested to know more, Populist Delusion, I talk about lots of things here in Applied Elite Theory. Also, there's an essay in here which is called The Paradox of Tony Blair, the Schmittian Liberalism of Divine Right. So these things, once you see them, once you understand Schmitt, you start actually seeing it in hidden forms all over the place. So he provides fantastic analytical tools. If you're even more interested, you can pick up Foundations of Politics. That's a great course to go alongside this. I have many other courses: Foundations of Economics, Shakespeare. I've got 5 books in Shakespeare, and or 6 now, because there's the Foundations of Shakespeare book as well. That's a great course. The Trivium is the bestseller. Research, you can get them all together in the Ultra Bundle. I will play that ad now, and I'll catch you all next time.
Ultra Bundle! 7 courses. Shakespeare! Research! The Trivium! Economics! Politics! The Ultra Bundle! Buy it now!
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.